Welcome to the RCGP podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm the Essential Knowledge Update Fellow. And today I'm talking to Professor Willie Hamilton, who is a professor of primary care cancer research. And this is an update about cancer detection in primary care. Hi, Willie.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me to come along.
Great to have you again. And I was just reflecting, I think people may have listened to our previous podcast, which was 3 years ago. So welcome back, everybody. And really good to have a chat about this important area for GPs.
Agreed. And things have changed a fair bit in the last 3 years, Tom, as you well know.
So in terms of cancer, we know the 1 in 2 lifetime risk, but we are seeing increasing numbers of cancer patients per GP. And I think that's partly also because our GP numbers are quite static in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the population total is increasing. So I think the number of patients per head of general practice is actually slightly rising. Plus, we've still got an aging population as my generation starts to get older and starts to get cancers. Whenever I started in this game, it was 250,000 new cancers a year. It's now well over 300,000, perhaps even 250,000 in England. And that this will rise a bit more in years to come.
What about that changing epidemiology in cancer? So we are seeing some more cancers in young people.
You're right, particular one that exercises us in both the clinical community and the cancer research community is colorectal, where there is increasing number of people under 50 developing colorectal cancer, and indeed under 40 developing colorectal cancer. So the under 40s make up something like 7% of colorectal cancers nowadays. It should be easy in many ways because you're young. And therefore, if you can diagnose the cancer in time, you should do very well because of the advantages of youth. The snag is don't bear that out. You do just as badly if you develop colorectal cancer under 40. And it's largely due to diagnostic delays. And I fully understand it because the symptoms are the same as they are in the elderly, but obviously of less risk per symptom. You and I always joke about PPVs and you think I'm defined by the positive predictive value, which is the risk of you harboring a cancer if you experience a symptom. So you, Tom, I'm guessing you're 20, 25 years younger than me. If you develop rectal bleeding now, your chance of being colorectal cancer is much lower than mine. And therefore, it's more likely that I'll be investigated than you are. But if I start making you 30 or 35, Tom, then the chance of it being colorectal cancer is tiny, but not zero. So the research community is desperately trying to find some way of identifying a symptom pattern or something else that can help us to investigate the under 40s in a way that doesn't overwhelm services.
Absolutely. And I think we'll come on to fit testing later on, which is a really good evidence-based tool we can use in primary care. And I think the evidence has obviously shifted and changed both for screening and symptomatic diagnosis for that.
It has indeed, yeah.
I guess reflection on why general practice primary care is so important in this area. I think, you know, obviously we can support screening, but obviously the majority of patients are diagnosed following a primary care referral.
Yeah, I think if you look at the other routes to cancer diagnosis, and then they're small. Screening detected cancers amount for at best 5% of the cancers in this country. Those with emergency presentations are down to 19%. And indeed, some of those emergency presentations, approximately half, have seen their GP with a symptom that retrospectively can be related to the cancer. I crucially use the word retrospectively, can be related to the cancer. So that leaves you somewhat, well, 75% of it if all the emergency admissions aren't counted as having seen a GP, but let's bring 10% back in who have seen their GP. So approximately 80 to 85% of cancers are going to come to you and me, and therefore we have to be on our toes. There's no way around it.
Yes, absolutely. I always talk to my students and trainees about, you know, a lot of symptomatic presentation, but it's picking that needle in the haystack, you know, that rectal bleeding, as you say, most is going to be piles or fissures or whatever, but, you know, it's having that threshold and maybe lowering their threshold to do investigations, particularly evidence-based tests.
Exactly. We've been doing this for decades. Obviously, we've tightened this up with NICE guidances in 2015, helping us GPs, but it's still experience and wisdom. And that's why general practice is so key in this subject, is we GPs aren't just number totters. We're using experience and the understanding there is just something different in this patient. I can't research that sort of quintessence, but it's very real.
coming on to screening, so we said it's a minority of cancers, maybe 5 to 6%, but generally those cancers are detected at an earlier stage. But of course, there's evidence-based criteria, National Screening Committee, etc. So we'll maybe reflect on a little bit of some of the changes in screening that might impact GPs. So obviously, yeah, in primary care, we're involved in cervical screening, and that has had some significant changes. So we've moved to 5-yearly cervical screening, but also we'll be coming in this year, we hope, self-testing, which we demonstrated for women who find a speculum painful, that would be a good option, and it is evidence-based.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, cervical screening has been a spectacular success. And what you say about self-testing is just so much nicer. It's just so much more patient-centered than coming to the surgery. And however good and experienced my team are at offering a within-surgery cervical screening, it's an undignified procedure. Let's not pretend it isn't. But there is good news on the horizon. Just as we've started to make cervical screening more patient-friendly, the need for cervical screening is declining. And it's declining because of the spectacular success of the vaccination program. And it certainly has been talked about for the last decade that there will come a time when we no longer need to do cervical screening. They were very loud, the mutterers, 10 years ago. They went very quiet. But the muttering has started again, and it wouldn't surprise me if we get to a stage where the harms of cervical screening exceed the benefits, all based on successful vaccination. So this is a success, not a failure.
And I'd say there might be some further changes, but obviously that's the one that's embedded in primary care. So some changes, we as GPs might not be doing it, but certainly our nursing colleagues in our practices will be running programs. What about changes in bowel cancer screening? So there's been some significant changes there with age reductions and also the threshold of FIT. And we'll be talking about FIT, of course, during the symptomatic section of this podcast.
Yeah, FIT has been a spectacular success. It's more sensitive than fecal occult blood. It's easier to take the sample, and therefore the public acceptability of FIT has been higher than FOBS. The threshold in this country is coming down, in England that is coming down to try and catch up with the Scots, and so that a threshold of 80 will come in. There's a lot of modelling being done within the colonoscopy community to see how that can be handled, because obviously once you bring the threshold down, you need more colonoscopies, and where can they be found in an already heavily stretched service? And so when we start talking about symptomatic FIT, we can discuss where the solution for the colonoscopy problem. But this is good news. There's not that many colorectal cancers that fall between 80 and 120. So this should be seen as an incremental change rather than a massive step change, but it's a change in the right direction.
Absolutely. And age is going down to 50. And that's certainly in England. We can check with other devolved nations, and it'll be every 2 years. And interestingly, GPs may have in their clinical systems, and I know we get prompt fatigue, but I actually had a look at some patients yesterday, and it did come up going patient non-responder for bowel cancer screening. You get a little prompt in your EMIS or your electronic health system, and then you can discuss it with a patient. We know actually by having that discussion, you will increase the number of patients who take part in their bowel cancer screening. And we know certainly in deprived communities, ethnic minorities, those with health inequalities actually have the lowest uptake for not only cervical, but also bowel cancer screening and other screening measures. So I think the key thing there, we can have a role in trying to reduce some of these health inequalities.
Completely agree with you, Tom. The GP is essentially the strongest measure of success in encouraging people to take up screening programs. We haven't talked about the lung healthcare checks, but it's exactly the same, and mammography for that matter. Getting the GP involved, the way you described it, was almost a personal thing, is you ringing up or messaging the patient saying, look, I've spotted that you haven't done X, can we talk about it or encourage it? One point I think we need to emphasize, and this is no different from 3 years ago, is a negative screening test is not an absolute. And if the patient presents with symptoms of the cancer, don't be put off investigating the symptoms of the cancer just because they've had a negative screening test in the months before. False negatives occur in all screening programs.
Absolutely. And it's a different threshold. So I think my key thing, it would be if you got a negative bowel cancer screen and they're coming then with symptoms a little bit while later, just refresh and go from scratch. Almost ignore that previous one. Don't be biased by that. And don't let the patient be biased by it.
Yeah, exactly. If I could throw in a completely side point here, Tom, it is the same goes for comorbidities. Let's take the patient with COPD who then gets increasing shortness of breath or he vomits or something. It's very easy to attribute the new symptom to the COPD and to be slower to investigate. There's a big program of work being largely completed now showing that it's just as important to investigate in patients with comorbidities. Actually, oddly, again, this is another GP success story. Oddly, GPs are doing this, and cancer is diagnosed at a slightly earlier stage in patients with comorbidities than without. So not only has the message got home, but it's really got home. Again, this is another success, going back to that first point we were discussing about how important are GPs. That is, no, you worded it, but that's how I want to answer it.
Very briefly on other bits of screening, so people be aware of the high-risk lung screening, so that's based on smoking history. The key role of the GP there is that we code the smoking in the clinical record. So I would say like coding is caring, so make sure you code into the clinical notes. And we know that is showing a little bit of stage shift for lung cancer detection.
Yeah, completely agree. I have to say coding is crucial. I've spent the last 25 years doing research on GP records. Better you keep the record. Easier is for you as a practice to identify those most at risk.
Yeah, been in the news, quite controversial around PSA. So obviously, us working in this field and GPs will know that it's not a great screening test. False positive, false negatives. So obviously, there's been a big evidence-based look at this, but it's still quite a controversial topic. But we know there's more research. For example, the Transform trial will be looking at this in more detail.
I personally was happy with the NSC's decision, particularly a decision that says, look, this isn't cast in stone forever, but at present the evidence does not support prostate cancer screening in that the harms outweigh the benefits. I think that is a reasonable position. There's also the position of the non-white community, and particularly the black community, who do have more prostate cancer identified. Some of that is due to the fact that the black community have a higher baseline BSA. So they simply, by virtue of being black, more black men will be identified as having a raised PSA and then will be found to have prostate cancer, which may be incidental or may be overdiagnosed. So the black community, there's a lot of really subtle nuances in how we proceed to, again, make sure we help people, not harming them. But that is very much something for the future. For now, I think the NSC have made the right decision. The decision may change in the future.
And like we said, there's always potential harms. I always go back to the Wilson-Junger criteria, which we remember at medical school, but it's all about having that pre-diagnostic period, simple, easy-to-use test that's got good sensitivity and specificity and reducing harm. You know, always thinking about potential harms and overdiagnosis.
I remember I had a lecture from Sir Muriel Gray, the sort of doyen of this epidemiology, and he said, all screening programs do harm, some produce benefit. And I thought that was a really key statement. But let's not get totally messed up about harm. There's four screening programs that do provide good. Yep, so we're not any screening, Tom. We're just appropriate screening.
Absolutely. Just to touch on briefly that there is further studies on the horizon and coming in. So I'm working on a capsule sponge trial called BEST4. This is the fourth trial in this area, but that's using a capsule sponge to detect Barrett's esophagus and adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, which obviously have poor outcomes. But GPs may be copied into some records about that screening program. No active GP involvement at the moment, but we might notify you about that study. And that's a big trial of thousands of people that's ongoing at the moment. And obviously there's been the NHS Gallery trial, which GPs might have been aware of, which is called a multi cancer early detection test, or MCED, and that we are hoping is going to report in the next 12 months.
Yeah, I think it might even be earlier than that, Tom. And the interim report was an equivocal result, but the devil will be in the details. My ear to the ground suggests whether the main paper will be out within a matter of months rather than longer than that.
And just to find those people, if you want to learn more about MCED, I've got a really neat paper in BJGP, which goes through a little bit about what these tests mean. Definitely more research coming in this area, both for screening and for symptomatic presentation. Yeah. So there's a lot of research and interest in these. So I think GPs, just to keep ahead of the curve, maybe just have a little read about in our article in the British Journal of General Practice.
I'm glad you brought up the symptomatic diagnosis. My personal view is they may have a role to play in the patient with non-specific symptoms, the weight of loss, the thrombocytosis individual, the abdominal pain that doesn't feel right person. In them, the symptom is real, but it could, if it's cancer, signify one of multiple cancers. Particularly, we're going to come in a minute to the demise of rapid diagnostic centers. And MCEDs might help us fill that gap, although they're not ready to do that yet. The HTA is doing a lot of work trying to pull together the evidence of where MCEDs will fit in that. At present, I think we have to sit tight, wait until the results emerge, and then see where MCEDs fit in. Potentially, they could be very large.
And then moving into the big bit of general practice, which is our symptomatic presentations, bread and butter, you know, picking out, like we've said, that needle in the haystack, trying to pick out those maybe 9 or 10, I think it's increasing a little bit, used to be 8 or 9 cancers, but if we're full-time GP per year, you know, they've got some good evidence, you know, going back to your work, Willie, about PPVs, NICE is now more than 10 years old, so 11 years this year, but still very relevant today, I think, and the research-backed approach and incremental change.
Actually, that has been such a sort of stable finding for 15 to 20 years. The PPVs that myself and my team and other workers around the country have produced, and that they largely underpin the 2015 NG12 NICE guidelines, have stood the test of time. We thought over time they might change, but the few times we've opened the box again and looked again, the figures have been almost exactly the same. I think what has changed is not the symptom patterns and the risks of the symptom patterns. What has changed so much in the last few years is the testing and the testing of the tests. To take an example, CA125, the blood test for ovary, where, if I'm honest, it was a little bit of educated guesswork that came up with a figure of 35 international units per litre to define a positive. Garth Funston has done an awful lot of work now defining that and splitting it down by age and whatever, and this is getting in to revision of the NICE guidance, giving slightly different values for young women and for older women so that we can be more nuanced in our testing of women with possible ovarian cancer.
And I think a lot of work also looking at risk stratification, people interested in that, changes in blood tests and potentially how we can utilise that with the primary care record in the future.
I mean, there's always a tension in national guidance between simplicity and then everybody understands it and they use it, and accuracy, where you can use, I mean, we can produce fabulous formulae which slightly refine the risk when a patient has symptom X, symptom Y, and symptom Z. But actually, the benefits in predicting from this fancy formula are often outweighed by the complexity of the formula. And once you start adding AI on top of that, where not only is the formula complex, you can't even see inside it and see what it's doing, it gets more tricky. You lift open the door for me to talk about where fit has changed in the symptomatic arena. And currently we have a one-size-fits-all value. If the value is above 10 micrograms per gram of feces, then that defines a positive and that goes on for investigation. The GPs listening to this podcast will know now that you can't get urgent suspected cancer referral without having done a fit unless there's a rectal mass or an abdominal mass, and both of these are vanishingly rare. What has been discovered is that fit alone can be improved by bringing in markers of the full blood count and bringing in age. I mean, age is no surprise, but platelet count and MCV are both relevant in that equation. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty soon it will come in that there will be a formula, and the formula will be calculated at the lab level, so that if you send a patient with a colorectal cancer symptom, instead of you getting a report that says your patient's fit level is 12, refer on a USC, it'll say your patient's fit level of 12, taking into account their MCV of 79 and their platelet count of 430, their risk of cancer is 7%. We very strongly suggest you do a USC referral. So you will be given quite tight advice, allowing you to refine the risk a lot. Indeed, where it really yields benefits is actually avoidance of colonoscopy in those who are genuinely low risk. And most of the modelling behind this suggests you can get the same number of cancers that you always got for something between 15 to 20% fewer colonoscopies.
Which is important given the pressure on the service. And I think, as you say, this is that neat number because it is a continuous variable. Yeah. The higher the number, the more correlated it is with both cancer and serious bowel pathology.
Exactly. It makes sense, but it makes sense also to add in these other variables. But imagine if I cut the colonoscopy numbers down by 20%. The ones that they do are more quick because the queue's shorter, and some of them can be diverted to the screening program. So this is a real win-win. And there's a lot of pilots going on in England currently. There's a few roadblocks we have to get past. One in particular is the legal position that you wouldn't believe the amount of paperwork behind applying a formula in the NHS as opposed to applying a single threshold. Tom, I had brown hair before I started this, and I can promise you it's white now. But the NHS is very keen to bring this in. Those legal difficulties will be got over. And I think within the next year or two, GPs will get more nuanced replies when they submit a fit. But the message for the GP is if you're doing a fit, do a full blood count at the same time and expect to see informative replies.
And I should just reflect in the symptomatic section about with the good news story, because actually more GP referrals are leading to improved outcomes and reduced emergency presentations, which have worse outcomes, and also improved stage one and two cancers. So I think often we feel we're getting bashed by the media as GPs, but actually this is a good news story that we're referring more people are being picked up with cancer.
Yeah, it's far too self-effacing here. It was a large result of your work, recognizing that increased, at that point it was too big weight, but I have to say USC referrals was related to better cancer mortality at a practice level. And that was really quite impressive. I mean, there is a point when the USC referral numbers will have to stop. I mean, we're over 3 million now. We're going up still by about 10% a year. I personally think this is good. It's whether we can go direct to test and avoid some of the USC referrals and be more efficient that way. Is we tried it within NICE 2015 and weren't terribly successful. But yeah, it's good news.
Just to flag that quite a neat audit to have a look at your practice referral data. That's really available on fingertips, and it's got 5 years combined data that shows your cancer detection, your referral rate. So you can compare your practice to your neighbourhood practices and your PCN and your ICB area. So I think that's quite a neat data you can have a little look at.
I completely agree, Tom, and it's very interesting to do that. What I wouldn't get over-exercised about is the conversion rate, which is the percentage of your USC referrals which transpire to have cancer, because I'm not yet sure if a good conversion rate, in other words, 20% of them coming through, is better than a poor conversion rate. Well, I just want to capture the cancers. You can have a brilliant conversion rate. You're only referring the one patient with a huge breast lump.
Wow. And I think actually the higher the conversion rate probably shows that you have a strong gatekeeping, which we, you know, overall gatekeeping is a good thing from Barbara Starfield's work, but actually too strong a gatekeeping in cancer can lead to worse outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. I loved looking at my data and all sorts of things as a GP, but by all means look at this and just compare, but compare thinking with your colleagues in a practice meeting about whether what is good news or bad news.
And I think our research has shown that you can utilize that in a practice meeting as QI type project. It's quite helpful as well. Coming on to maybe the more difficult to diagnose cancer. So from your work, Willie, we know probably around half of cancers who present symptomatically are with vague, or we might call that non-specific symptoms. And I remember some of our teaching, we've talked about the ping pong patient that can lead to diagnostic delay and a diagnostic odyssey.
I would say the figure half has sort of crept in without evidence. To be fair, I brought in the figure of 30% with a minor amount of evidence. It doesn't really matter. We don't need to argue about the exact percentage, but there's certainly this decent number of patients who present with a non-specific symptom. I defined non-specific earlier, meaning it's not vague. I hate the word vague because that implies you don't believe the patient. It's non-specific that if it's cancer, I don't know which cancer it is, and there's a list of possible cancers. And the intra-abdominal is the obvious one. Yeah, the ping pong patient exists. This is someone who you send to one USC referral, it's negative. You send to a second USC referral, it's negative. And then finally, the third one, you discover it's pancreas. And these stories are also real. This is where the rapid diagnostic centers had their place. It's very sad they have lost their funding over time. These rapid diagnostic centers took your patient. You did a battery of bloods at the beginning, and sometimes just X-ray, sometimes a fit, and then said, I'm still mystified. And they would do various tests under one house at one time. And so the patient was dealt with from a cancer perspective very well. The yield was too high in that we were probably sending patients that the cancer was obvious. It was at 10 or 11%. And I think most of us in the research world wanted that to be lower and more patients to go through it. For whatever reasons, it's gone.
Well, I should say to a caveat that in some areas it's gone because it was local funding with your Cancer Alliance. So I know in London, in some areas, do have it still, and it's been embedded and working really well. So I think the key thing is just look up in your area. If you do have it, use it, because if you don't use it, you may lose it. So I think some areas do have it, some areas don't. But obviously, you've got to think about that non-specific patient, how best to manage it, because it is more difficult. Fundamentally, it's actually about accessing diagnostics. So I think in our area, we are giving GPs access if they've got weight loss for CT, abdomen, particularly for pancreas. So you may find in your area, you're getting more access to CT. And we think that probably is a good thing.
I think it is. There's always been the talk from the radiologists, we GPs don't know how to send patients for tests. And I think that's wrong. I think we do CT scans, avoiding a need for a specialist referral. Why can't I do CT brain? Why can't I do CT abdo? I'm fully qualified. I think that argument has been one that we GPs know what we're doing, which brings us to community diagnostic hubs. And these are the hubs that have been sent around the country. Now, you gave me some impressive number. Did you say 130 roughly?
I think around 170 when I checked.
You pointed out in our chat before this podcast that they're all rather secondary care. They're not quite the Hamilton-approved model of them being in the high street of your city or your decent-sized town. My model would be that Monday is chest day, Tuesday is gynae day, Wednesday's belly day. And I bet so the patients could be sent in by the GP almost directly to this one and get their battery of chest tests or gynae tests or whatever. Your work that I said earlier about the number of USC referrals is related to better mortality. Well, the number of tests you do is also likely to be related to better mortality. We've got to the stage we're already testing smarter because we know who we should be testing. We still have to test more, and making it easier for us to do tests is the way forward. Community Diagnostic Centres 2.0, if anybody listens to me, will be closer to the patient.
Willie, you're a little bit involved in some of the work around sort of younger patients with cancer, and the sad case about Jess Brady. So some GPs may be aware of that. She contacted a practice many times before she was ultimately diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and sadly passed away. So we talk about this 3 strikes rule. I mean, I remember medical school training and GP training. This is not a new rule, but it's something we need to reflect on, that if someone is presenting 3 or more times with unexplained symptoms, really just take a step back, think about that, get advice. Do I need to do some tests? Do I need to get an advice from a colleague? Do I need to refer? So I think it's an inflection and a reflection point.
I mean, I think it was a ghastly case, an absolutely appalling case of a very young woman with a totally unexpected cancer, with very haphazard healthcare, seeing tens of different clinicians at different times and the penny not dropping. To some extent, I think the 3 strikes in your in rule is sensible because it sort of codifies what we should have been already doing. And I think there was this, to use a Bayley term, there was a collusion of anonymity in the Jess case, where it was very easy to say that the next one's job to sort this one out, and the patient was passed on. Absolute tragic case. But if we can learn from it, it's good. But we really mustn't forget the fact that GPs can generally recognize the sick community from the non-sick community and within cancer, because that fabulous paper of Bianca Wearing's, whereby we looked at patients with a headline symptom of cancer, and surprising number weren't referred. Yet the cancer yield in the unreferred was much lower than in the referred. It wasn't low enough, but it was much lower. So GPs are pretty good.
That's selecting the cases. Yeah, exactly. And I think that leads neatly on about safety netting. That is really important. So if you're not sure, you know, share that with the patient. If you're ordering a fit test, explain the fit test, have some safety netting. And I think most practices now will have a good USC safety netting system. So that will be where you flag to your admin team, I'm doing a USC, and they kind of chase that up, make sure the patient has an appointment. But it's kind of having that safety netting also within your own clinical practice. I use text messaging and other tools. Patients don't remember a lot about what we talk about. So, you know, think about all those stuff that you can do in your own consultation to help safety net patients.
And of course, it's always easy when you've got practice with stable staffing and helping with continuity and things like this. And sadly, there are still some practices who aren't able to offer that continuity and who are so overworked, it's very difficult. So access to general practice remains a problem. I don't think you and I should pretend it isn't. But if you could get in, we can still offer good service.
You've recently working on something called the ERICA trial, Willie, which I understand is clinical decision support systems in primary care, about how we can utilize some of the research around symptoms to potentially prompt testing. So is that reporting soon?
Well, we got the data request in and they were discussing with the data people as we talk today. So I'm hoping to get the data in the next few months. It'll take quite a while to crunch the data. So I'm still aiming for a 2026 result. And that will tell us whether these electronic prompts that pop up when the patient's symptoms add up to a risk of cancer of above 2% actually has some value or not. Obviously, it should help, but the obvious is sometimes wrong.
And I guess when we chat again, maybe in 3 years' time, Willie, if we're still well and around, we might have more research about AI and other tools that are coming in, people looking at straight to tests. And also, for example, if a woman has a breast lump above 40, I understand there's a pilot program for that, potential pilot patients to self-test FIT testing. So I think that's a lot of interest around making it easier for patients to test for their cancers and also the role of AI.
Self-testing to me is perfectly okay. I know people worry about hypochondriacs and people overusing the service are going again and again. And again, against that, being able to look after your own health and go to where you need to go. If I'm honest, if a woman presents to me with a breast lump, she's presenting to me because she's using me as an entry route to specialist care to find out about this breast lump. I'm not saying I don't add anything to that consultation. I hope I do. But there are some simple things that direct access and direct testing will work for. We've done direct testing for pregnancy. We've done direct testing for COVID. We've years past direct testing for TB. Why not? AI is more tricky. It's such a fast-moving field. All I can say is it's likely AI will improve predictive equations a bit. How much and how much will the benefits pay off against the disbenefits of the opacity of it? Computers says you need a USC referral is a very difficult thing to get across. Or worse still, computer says you don't need a USC referral is hard to get across. So I'm not being Luddite here. I think there will be a place. Just how big a place it is, I'm not sure.
And I think the key bit is trust your judgment, trust your clinical acumen. GPs are important in this area.
We would say that, wouldn't we, Tom? But the slang is, it's the truth.
Thank you so much, Willie. And just to signpost, if you want to learn more, we've got our courses on the e-learning platform. We've been doing yearly one-day essentials on cancer. So that is, as an RTGP member, you can log in. And some of that's with Willie, some with myself, some with other experts in the field who are GP researchers in the cancer area. So I think all that's really good to have a look up on the college website. And say thank you, Willie, very much for joining us. It's been a really great discussion today.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you for listening to RTGP Podcasts.